This podcast is in no way affiliated with the Stars production or Diana Gabaldone. All views expressed are solely our own. Welcome to the Outlander podcast,
where the men are kilted, the women are winsome,
and the whiskey is neat. Welcome to episode 299 of the Outlander podcast. I'm Ginger.
And I'm Summer, and we are in love with all things Outlander.
So I hear a third voice, or people are going to hear a third voice. So who is joining us?
Hi, how's it going?
We teased her last week.
That's true. Lene, did you listen last week?
I did listen last week.
Just because we told you you should?
I did. No, I listened because you said something to me about it. And I'm like, oh, I've been so freaking busy lately. It's insane. So I haven't had time for much of anything.
But did we say your name enough?
Yeah, you said it quite a few times.
It was like Beetlejuice. We said it three times and she appeared.
And she appears.
Lenny.
That's hard to say. I never called her Lanny or Lenny ever.
I didn't mean to. I'm trying to say it quickly, but it's hard to say it because the emphasis is on the second syllable.
I mean, it's been 20 years. I can say Lenny without any difficulty.
Yeah, but I've never tried to say it that fast three times. Okay, so since we have our own Beetlejuice Lenny.
Yes.
There are horses in the chapter.
Yes, there are.
There's more goats. More goats than horses, really.
Kittens are mentioned, but they're not necessarily in the chapter.
We are moving on to our read-along. This week, we will be discussing chapter 27, entitled Death Comes Calling. And in case I didn't say it, which I know that I didn't, we are continuing our The Fiery Cross read-along.
So the last chapter ended with identical twins. One had a brand. He was getting the brand on his thumb, cut off, sliced off, and then seared with hot metal to get rid of the brand. And that was Jamie. And we find out that Josiah has an identical twin. And then at some point, I guess it was we find out Keziah is his name, but the twin who was actually cuddled up next to Claire like a kitten wakes up, sees everything, and he runs off. I don't know which order. But the boys run off and Jamie's like, oh, gosh. And he's gone for hours. And then when he's back, the boys are gone. No, the boy's gone. Either way, he comes back and they're like, she's like, OK, you need to get a little more sleep. And he's like, not going to happen. He's like, now I got to figure out what the hell I'm going to do. So this chapter starts out a little bit later because they're about to leave. So it's not almost morning. It is morning. We find out what happened in all the hours that Jamie was gone with trying to find Josiah. So the next day they break camp and they're on their way. And as they're on their horses and they're starting to make their way towards someplace, Claire orders Jamie to spill it. She's so impatient to hear what's up that she doesn't want to wait until Roger joins them. She's like, no, he'll find out later. Just tell me now. He says that the other one, the littler, the more malnourished bro, had come from a small farmhouse out in the distance. And he points to it and they see it and there's smoke coming out of it. Claire could even see that someone was walking around. And Jamie says that the inhabitants, or whoever lives down there in that house, they're just about to learn that the other boy, the second boy, is gone. So the other brother, the one curled up next to Claire, had been staying down there. And he had been up in that house up until the day before or early the night before. And we find out, or Jamie's reporting this, that the brothers had been bond servants. So basically they were nothing better than chattel.
They were basically kind of sold into slavery.
Exactly. So the night before, he'd run after Josiah, hearing his wheezing. That's how he probably would have caught up anyway. But because Josiah had so much wheezing and you could hear him in the dark, so Jamie was able to catch up with him. And then he gets their story. So he learned that their family were immigrants. Their father and mother and six kids had come over together, and only the two boys, the two young twins, had survived the passage. All the rest had died, or at least his family had died at sea. They had no known relatives, either in the colonies or to send them back to. Who knows? There was no way to contact anyone. So the ship's master sold them. And they were indentured for 30 years. And the boys had been two or three at the time of the crossing. And Josiah had no idea who his parents were, where they had come from, or even what their names were, whether last name, first name, anything. But he did know his and his brother's names, Josiah and Keziah. Beardsley is the name of the man who took them in. So the man who basically owned them. So what had happened was about 2 years before, Josiah had run away. Now they were, I don't know, at a market in a town somewhere. He was with his brother. Actually, his brother had stolen. Josiah ran away, but what caused him to run away was that he and his brother had stolen cheese from a dairy shed, and they were in Brownsville. But they were caught. They were seen. A dairy maid saw
one of
this,
them.
And then,
one of them, not both of them, did it. Only one of them, and one of them was caught.
But they were together. Only one of them took it, but they were together.
I think only one of them was seen, but Josiah took the blame.
They may have been together when they were caught, but I don't think they saw both of them together.
That's what I'm saying.
I think they were caught together eating the cheese. Yeah, Beardsley caught the two of them with it and mentioned it to the sheriff. So mm-hmm. he caught them both with the cheese, but they're not really sure who actually stole it. One of them did for sure.
Yeah, and Josiah
took the blame.
It was me.
Yeah, because he's very protective of his brother, whom we mm-hmm. learn later on is deaf. So Josiah takes the blame, and he was branded as a thief for that. It was after this that he runs away from the farm.
What kind of a brand did they put on his thumb?
That's really weird because, first of all, he's young. So his thumb is going to be smaller than an adult's.
Yeah.
But also, your thumb is so small, period. It's like a dinky little brand? I don't know. It's really small.
So it's a T? A letter T for thief is what they would do?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Man, burning your fingers hurts so bad.
Oh, my gosh.
It hurts so bad.
So does fracturing it. Believe me, I'm still.
And slicing the end of it off is even like worse. I've done that. Sliced the tip of my finger off, and that didn't feel so good.
Y'all need to be more careful.
Yeah, well, they were some sharp knives. Did I ever tell you about the time Andy's dad did that?
No.
Sliced the entire pad of his thumb off. It was the first family dinner I was invited to.
Lene, you know he wanted to make an impression.
And then get this.
His own thumb.
Get this. I catch him over the sink squeezing the blood out of his thumb. This is his dad, and his dad's a super sweet guy, but I'm like, what are you doing? He's like, you got to let it bleed. And I'm like, no. I learned first aid at Girl Scouts, and you wrap it up and apply pressure.
You got to make it stop bleeding, actually.
You got to make it stop bleeding.
Make it stop bleeding.
like Jamie cauterizing it, right?
He's like, you're the cutest girl our son has brought home. We don't want to run you off.
That was the same dinner that Aunt Jenny was like, personally, I like sex quite a lot.
Old ladies. I love old ladies.
Sorry, I'm totally getting off topic here.
That's but okay.
Yes, slicing the finger, yeah.
2 years earlier, this had happened, and he'd run off after that. He'd intended to return to rescue his brother. In general, what we don't get, I got the feeling that when I read that line, that he'd intended to rescue his brother earlier than 2 years.
yeah. He couldn't quite find the opportunity.
Yeah,
or he
maybe
was looking
exactly.
for a place for them, I think, is what they said. He wanted to make sure he had a place.
Because if he rescued him and took him out, then it was hard. It's because he was, well, not that he couldn't move.
Well, if
he
his
was
brother
mobile.
Was deaf, if his brother was deaf and he was branded a thief, they would already need some sort of place, housing or place to work or some sort of situation for them to go into. They couldn't just like go off and.
So even though he was quite late in getting back to his brother, 2 years, by the time he'd gone to the gathering and met Jamie and had that offer by Jamie, as far as, you know, joining them on the ridge and getting, you know, we're being with him, having a responsibility, maybe getting some land, etc. It had seemed like such a great opportunity. It seems a godsend to him. And that was the quote unquote, the business that he was inferring to. He was going, he had left the gathering when they did or around the same time, but he left on foot. And so he went, his idea was to go collect his brother and then make it back to the ridge so that they could start, he could start his end of the bargain. And anyway, so he was shocked that he would run into Jamie and Claire because he was waiting to see them back at the ridge. So Jamie had helped Josiah rescue his brother instead. So he told him everything, and then Jamie went down to the homestead to help him get Keziah. And Jamie said that he'd had fun. Quote, "It reminded me of raiding the Grand Slams with Dougal and his men when I was a lad. Creeping through the dark, stealing into the barn without a sound. I had to stop myself in time before I took the cow, or I would have if they'd had one."
Yeah.
Oh, Lord. And Claire tells him, quote, "You are the most complete bandit, Jamie," unquote. So their plan is that, or the plan now is that Roger will take the men on, the other men, whom the militia whom they've gathered, on to Brownsville while Jamie and Claire go on to call upon the Beardsleys. And he tells her, he's like, "Okay, you know all this stuff now." He tells her, you know, "Watch your face. You know how you are, Sassenach. Watch your face because you know all this stuff. Don't let on that you know about Keziah." And she just made me laugh. She tells him, "Mind your own face." I don't know why this is that funny, because it's not that funny, but it made me laugh. So then he goes on, as they're making their way down to the Beardsleys, we learn that Keziah is deaf, and he wasn't born deaf, but it's the result of an injury. And they believe it, or Josiah says it happened around age 5. So he could speak up till that time, or he could speak now even, because he had learned, he could hear and speak. He had all of his faculties up until age 5 or so. But now, although he could speak, he couldn't hear anything unless it was the loudest of noises. So because of that, he couldn't hunt. So he was pretty helpless, I guess, because he couldn't hear anyone approaching them. So he could easily be in danger, and he couldn't hunt because he couldn't hear.
That's why I think like he waited so long to try to find a place for them, for his brother, because like even though, I mean, they're both so small for their age because they both clearly are malnourished because they haven't been fed well. But and eventually they'll grow enough that they could start pulling their own weight as far as chores and things like that. But in the beginning, he is the only one that can like hunt and do other things like that because of his brother's deafness. I assume they were small for their age because they were malnourished. Because it sounds to me the way they're described is they could pass for like 12-year-olds.
And beaten.
And the one he talks about the one being bow-legged.
Yeah.
Rickets. That has rickets. So that's clear malnourishment. Yeah. And that totally affects your height and your growth, which makes me think they've both been malnourished and they're both small. And like I said, that would affect how much they can help as far as work and things
Correct.
Like that.
Now, it's interesting because we don't have any evidence that he was completely helpless in this area, but because it has been 2 years and there was some language in this chapter that either straight out stated it or alluded to the fact that he had in this time on his own, he had become such a good hunter in this time. That's when he learned to hunt. He had to teach himself. So that is actually, it doesn't help Jamie or the Ridge to have someone who happens to be under the age of the militia to have someone around. It doesn't help him to have a body unless that body has a very needed or very important skill. That is why he was a great hunter. He could bring in the skins and of course the meat. Mm-hmm. So he could help keep the Ridge fed while the men and the rest of the militia were gone.
Who typically are the ones who are doing the hunting.
Exactly. So it's not just he's young, he can stay. Yeah, I mean, that helped. The fact that he wanted the hunter.
He can stay, but he's also a good hunter.
The interesting thing about the Beardsleys, they need to have the Beardsleys in some capacity in the story. Because what we find out, I think, next chapter, which I have not reread yet, but after reading this chapter, like, I remember all the Beardsley stuff. Something happens, and the result of that something happened, and Roger's already on his way to Brownsville. Something happens with the Beardsley and a Brownsville. and has repercussions books from now. So yeah, they have to have Beardsleys at least a little bit, whether or not they keep Keziah, Josiah storyline intact. So it'll be interesting to see what they keep and what they don't keep. So why, and honestly, when I read this, I was like, wait, I totally missed it last chapter. No, I didn't go back and check, but I was like, oh, how do I miss this? So I think it was Claire, but in this chapter, next, the question is put to us, why didn't Keziah have breeches? I missed that he was half naked. So he'd taken them off the night before when he went to sleep in the barn. And overnight, one of the barn cats had kittens in them and he didn't want to disturb her. And I thought, that is so sweet. And also what I didn't notice, like, dang, Ginger, I must have been like zipping through the rest of the last part of that chapter, is that he also didn't have any shoes on.
I think that was actually probably more common than
I think you're right, because shoes are very expensive. Well, clothing in general is expensive.
Shoes back then, a lot of them weren't like a left and right shoe either. They were just like a leather kind of moccasin type thing, and you put them on the foot, and then they mold to your right foot or your left foot. Good shoes that were made by a cobbler with a sole and everything, and boots, much, much more sturdy and cost money.
Erica B. writes, these poor kids. Then to find out that Keziah is deaf too, geez Louise, they have not had it easy. And the icing on the cake, I think, was that the cat had kittens on one of their pants. I think the most fascinating thing about them so far is that they aren't complaining. They just accepted the situations in front of them and don't question it. A real testament to their resiliency. So by now, Roger has gone with the men. And this is both out of necessity. He needs to have the men continue on while he takes care of the Beardsley thing. And this is also a test for Roger. Jamie's like, how is he ever? And he's like, I don't think that the men are going to respect him. But the thing is, they're never going to respect him unless he's given this chance to actually be a leader. So it's kind of it's a double-edged sword. Yes, you can not be respected, but you know, you need to do this to actually have a chance to be respected. So he's giving Roger the much needed chance to perform, and not singing wise. He's fine with that. Jamie says that Beardsley's not infirm, meaning the guy who, you know, bought them, the guy who beat them, maybe, who knows. But they're approaching as they get closer to the homestead, he says that Beardsley was a trader with a local native tribes, specifically Cherokee. And so he may not have been rich, but he got a lot of stuff and he traded a lot of stuff. Now this line made me laugh, not because it's funny, but knowing what happens in the chapter makes it ridiculous. Quote, so this is from Claire, or Claire's mind. Quote, so he was counting on the Beardsleys being sufficiently hospitable as to put us up for the night.
One should write. We'll see what happens.
Right. Mm-hmm. So they approach the farmhouse. It's shabbier than it had appeared from a distance, and it seemed deserted. But they remember, Claire remembers seeing that woman or a figure walking around. And Jamie says that he'd told Josiah that if he'd meant to come to the ridge, meaning what they had agreed on, that they'd need to get, this is all conversation that he and Clara are having as they're riding their horses down to the, closer to the house. And he goes, this is why, the brand was cut off. Because after all of this, if they had to get rid of the brand to have a future on the ridge, because it could have brought drama, could have raised questions, and could have alerted the Beardsley in general.
Well, nobody wants to have somebody branded a thief on their land, because that creates, it breeds, you know, untrustworthiness. You know what I mean? So it's like, and if him having it and Jamie trusting him could cause people to stop trusting Jamie. So there's larger reaching things at work.
Mm-hmm.
So they approach the house and Jamie calls out, ho the house, not hello the house, ho the house. So apparently there's at least two ways to call out. Claire muses on how it was taken for granted that women were considered basically harmless. She thinks how easily she could have done stuff so many times if she'd been inclined. Quote, it had dawned on me now and then that the Hippocratic Oath and its injunction to do no harm might not have strictly to do with the medical procedure. Unquote. The Jamie approaches the barn first. Again, nothing. Claire notices that there are notches cut into the wood of the door jamb in groups of seven. And I thought, my first thought was, oh, obviously seven's a week. And then I thought, I wonder if that is days to weeks, weeks to months, and months to years for the boys. I don't know. The only thing we know right now that has any time attached to it is their indenture. That's my only guess.
Yeah.
But who knows? Who knows? So he knocks on the door. No one answers. But there's livestock there. They hear the goats. Plus, they saw that woman or the figure earlier. They know someone's there. The door won't budge. Jamie moves the muslin window covering, and he gets a noseful, meaning redonkulous stank.
But then you think about it when they start describing the stink. And how much of the stink is the closed-up cabin, and how much is it just the things they trade?
Well, that's the thing. Or the thing upstairs. Exactly. Who knows? There's a lot of stink.
I mean, forget the thing upstairs. Huh? But, I mean, it's like barrels prepared and preserved things that he trades with the Cherokee from the way they describe the whole chapter. So it's like, and then when they describe the back room once they get there, how clean it is.
I know, right?
And she keeps it clean that you're like, what are they smelling? Is it just like all the barrels of things that are like potentially rotting and or being preserved? Or is it the state of the loft?
Yeah.
So I take notes really shorthand. Jamie moves the muslin window covering after they hear this, what sounds like bleating coming from the cabin. From the door area. And that's when they get a noseful. Now, they could tell that the room within was large but crowded. Lots of, as Summer said, lots of the trade goods, lots of the stuff that was stored there for trade. But this noise, this really odd noise, continues. So Jamie tells Claire to get the pistols from the horse. But before she can go, a woman comes to the door, or I guess to the window, and says, "Go away." She has a slight lisp.
But say it with a lisp.
No, I don't do that.
There's no S's in
exactly.
that.
Exactly.
I know.
Go. I don't have. I have all my teeth. I don't know how to pretend I have teeth. Go away.
I don't know.
There's
either.
No S there, so it won't work. He mentions the woman has a slight lisp, and the woman, sorry, Jamie mentions he's there regarding this task he has to gather a militia, and is the man of the house there, et cetera, et cetera. Jamie's pushing back a little bit, and the woman says that the man of the house isn't fit for company. Now, Claire asks if he's ill. Jamie introduces at this point Claire as his wife, a well-known healer known as the White Raven. And this does mean something to the woman with the lisp. She kind of agog. She kind of stares and is taken aback, and she goes, oh, the Conjure Woman?
I thought this was strange. Given all of the things that this woman has clearly done to her husband post-apoplexy, I thought it was strange. She automatically just welcomed all of these people into her house.
Yeah.
She's like, oh, you're a Conjure Woman? Please come.
Yeah.
Please come into my house and look at all of the awful things I've done to my husband who broke all of my teeth out of my face.
She's afraid.
Her eyes are wide in alarm. Yeah,
she's afraid.
And she takes a step back.
Exactly.
But she didn't have to let them in.
Well, what was she going to do? Jamie's not.
She could have ran off immediately and been like, bye.
She could have run, but where was she going to go?
She could have gone any number of places.
Okay.
They don't know where she's going to go. They don't know her.
Yeah.
They don't know her business. They don't know that they're going to find some apoplectic man in a loft area in the cleanest part of the house that doesn't smell.
Yeah.
So after she kind of freaks about who Claire is, Claire is looking at this woman, and she realizes that despite the state of the home, despite the stank, despite everything they see, this woman is clean. Her hair is clean. Her face is clean. Her skin is clean. Her clothing is clean. And she does say that she's Mrs. Beardsley. And finally, I wrote invites them in, but come on, she was kind of cajoled into doing it, but whatever. Claire, as she moves away to go to open the door, Claire sees that she moves kind of with a not really a shuffle, but a drag. She She has one leg dragged. She was slightly lame in one leg. Mm-hmm. She opens the door and lets them in.
Hence might be the reason she didn't bolt and didn't run.
You can't bolt.
Exactly.
You can't bolt when you can't run.
Yes, ma'am. So
there's your reason, Summer. That's why she didn't
run. We're all kind of slow tonight.
Running, though. It's just the whole point where she's like, all right, fine, you're a conjure woman, come in. That would have been the least reason I would let somebody in. Yeah. I'd have been like, I've been torturing my husband, you're not allowed in here.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No.
So they come in and immediately the smell is worse.
Oh, yeah.
And Diana, I did not take any notes because y'all can go read it for yourself. Diana gives us all kinds of great descriptions for the foul smells.
They did their best to breathe through their mouth.
But at least she didn't taste it, because usually
she tells us the taste of everything. Correct.
When the smell is bad enough that you can taste it, get the hell out.
Exactly.
Let me tell you.
Exactly. You know it's bad.
Because I've been in all kinds of situations where the smell is so bad, you're like, I just got to focus on breathing in and out my mouth. Don't breathe through your nose. I've been there, but it's like, gross. So gross. Because you just start thinking about, if that kind of smell is in the air, then there's
poop
there's
in the
particles
air.
Of it
you're
in the air.
Poop in your mouth. Yeah,
and you're getting it in your mouth and on your tongue, breathing through your mouth. So that grosses me out even more. But whatever, you know, do what you got to do to get through.
Erica B. writes: they approach the house and almost immediately realize something is off, but they can't figure out what exactly. The house is in disrepair and overall in disgusting shape. What's weird, though, is that Mrs. Beardsley seems to be cleaner than expected. So Claire mentions, quote, people generally didn't bathe for several months in the cold weather, unquote. Ugh. I can't even imagine.
I can't fathom.
I can't.
I'd expect.
If I go 24 hours without bathing, like, you know, when you go camping.
Okay, look, I can go 48 without being like, I am a disgusting, filthy animal. But like after 48, I'm like, no one should be anywhere near me.
Yeah.
This was not my idea, but I reek.
This was not my idea, but I reek.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
It's not my idea that my pores do this, but it happens in there.
No. My whole point is I always shoot for at least 48. But if something happens between me showering at 48 and me not showering at 48, it was never my intention.
Yeah,
it was not my intention, and I apologize.
It was out of my hands. That's funny. I apologize.
I did what I could. I'm sorry.
So, Lene, you're every 24, imagine. Summer. No, okay, hold on.
No.
But there's a difference.
I take showers probably more than most people. Well,
but you're also
– I'm outside.
You're outside. You're around animals. You sweat a lot, I'm guessing, because you're so bloody active.
Especially during the summer.
And you're on horses a lot.
I walked off. Yeah. No, today at the barn, like we had a long day at the barn and I was turning out horses and riding horses and everything. And then I get home. We didn't get home till like 2:00 and we were sweating. And it wasn't even super hot today. It didn't even hit 90. It was nice today, and I still, because it's dust, and you know, I put sunscreen on because we were in the sun, and then the dust kicks up at the barn, and then it sticks to you, so you have this layer of like filth all over you. I can't stand it. I can't do anything until I go home and shower. I just go straight home and shower. No stopping. Like if the kids are hungry on the way home from the barn, I'm like, we'll go through the drive-thru because I am not stopping.
That's saying something, because Lene is very
stinky.
She's totally not stinky.
I smell
Summer.
Nice.
No, she what does. I'm trying to say, that is
she
saying something because
she keeps it tight.
No, that's Claire. No, Lene is very hands-on, not overly so, because she leaves her. She expects her kids to do a lot of things for themselves. So she's
Here's the larger thing.
To take her kids to drive-thru and say, we're just going to go get it. She's like, she's serious.
Yeah.
But here's what I'm saying. What I'm going to say is that she spends a lot of time with horses.
Yes.
And horses, as animals, they're not stinky, but they're not fresh smelling to a degree.
I like their smell.
Yeah, I like the horse smell.
But you walk away from caring for a horse smelling horsey.
No, I have known people who like come to the barn to like before they go to work, they're just going to like turn their horse out or do whatever real quick with their horse or turn them out in a pasture. I'm like, I can't even walk through the barn and then leave without feeling dirty. Because it's just so
dusty. Your shoes alone are destroyed.
Yeah, It's just like, I can't. And people would do it before going to work and not get dirty. I'm like, I can't walk in a barn without like something getting on me.
Yeah. That's, to me though, that's like when you have that bike to work month, like that's a thing in the state. Yeah. And I'm like, ew, if I biked to work, I would need
sweaty,
to take
gross mask.
I would need to take a shower and a change of clothes.
If there was like a gym at work, if there was a gym that had showers, that'd be one thing, but I'm not biking to work.
No, but think about it. If I already work at 7 o'clock in the morning, if I was biking to work and then taking a shower, I would have to leave my house at 5 o'clock to be able to get there in time to take a shower.
Forget that nonsense. No, I usually shower at least at least twice a day.
This is
I'm not even kidding.
So okay, that was my question. So shower wise, you shower, you like to shower at least once a day.
On average, twice a day.
Okay. So Summer,
because usually I'm doing stuff with animals in the morning. And I'll shower. And then sometimes I have to go out in the evenings and take care of dogs and stuff in the evenings. And it's hot in the summer.
Yeah.
And so I'll get all sweaty again. And I might not – I don't wash my hair that every time I shower, but because I have curly hair. But I do at least hop in and give a quick rinse so that I get whatever sweat was on me off. And then like, you know.
So that's where I was curious.
I can't lay in bed at night. I cannot lay in bed at night.
That's gross. Why do you want to get the nasty sweat on your sheets? Because then
if you shower the next day,
you're just getting back in bed with the nasty, stinky, sweaty mess you were yesterday.
Yeah. It's so gross. So gross. I can't do it. I can't like sweat.
So Summer, your hard pass, unless something goes wrong, is 48 hours. Or your hard stop is 48 hours. Lene, yours is...
Here's the thing. No. 48 hours of inactivity. Like 48 hours
not going
of
to the gym.
Like,
walking outside too much.
48 hours of like
not sweating.
Getting in my car and driving to work, sitting at my desk all day, and then coming home and like yelling at my kid and then going to bed. I don't consider that like a strenuous. Like if I had 2 days of that, I absolutely need to take a shower by the end of two of those days. However, if one of those days included me like being like, hey, there's this new Harry Potter game called Wizards Unite. It's like Pokemon Go, only with Harry Potter. And I took my daughter and we walked the neighborhood for 2 miles and I came home and I didn't take a shower. The next day I'd be like, no, this is done. I should have taken a shower last night. I'm filthy. It's not okay.
Okay, so your showers are that. What about your hair? Lene, you said you don't do hair every day, but do you?
I don't wash my hair, but a couple times a week because of curls.
Yeah, curly hair, you really can't wash it. I mean, you can wash it every day.
If you want to have a frizzy, afro.
It just is a lot more work. It's easier to do at least every other day. But I wash my body. I'm telling you, like being able to shower two times a day when I'm doing activities, it's ruined camping for me because after camping and being outside and kind of sweaty and gross for like one day, I can hardly sleep at night when I'm camping because I've been sweating all day. And then I'm trying to get in a sleeping bag and sleep. No, thank you. I need a cabin where I can take a shower and that's all there is to it. I can't camp anymore. I can't stand it. That's the worst part of camping for me.
Oh my gosh.
Is not being able to shower. I'm totally, totally weird about it now.
So weird.
I love camping. So I love being out in nature and I love being outside. I'm a total nature person, but I don't want to take the nature with me to bed.
Except for when you do. And then it's awesome.
Unless his name is Andy.
That's right. He's so natural, that Andy.
So my husband, by the way, for all you, so you don't.
So Erica B. continues, I find it disconcerting. She's all, quote, if you find the deaf one, you can keep him, unquote, meaning Mrs. Beardsley. Not one, not even really caring who was at her door and not 1 ounce of care for the young man. I just find it odd. Even if it was just care of her, quote unquote, property. Did anyone else feel like this house could be seen on the latest episodes of Hoarders?
For sure, but only the front room, because that's where all the hoarding was happening. Because in the back, it was sparse and clean and kept and whatever. And I feel like we all have to stop gazing Mrs. Beardsley through the
window
filter of what you expect of a mommy kind of stepmother kind of relationship because she's been through a lot. So you can't, she cannot concern herself with the bond servants. She just can't because she is being beaten from day to day and running from her quote unquote husband, who is supposed to be caring for her. She can't concern herself with other people.
No, and so it does naturally, you think, well, if she's being beaten and injured and abused, she would be sympathetic to the others in the household that are being beaten and abused. But I've heard of many situations where there's families where there's multiple kids that are being abused that they kind of get, it's like Lord of the Flies mentality of saving yourself.
But think about it. She and the boys might also be thinking in their own little brains, because they're probably not talking, where she's like, why aren't you helping me? He beats me. And they're like, why aren't you helping me? Yeah. He beats me. Nope. And if they have this disconnect between the two of them of why aren't you helping me? And neither of them are helping each other because they literally can't, because they have nothing else to give.
Mr. Beardsley also could have done that, tried to work before he had a thing. He could have been very threatening to either or both parties, to like, you ever come near, you ever get in between me and my wife, you'll die, or something like that.
Yeah, no, that's true. That's true.
So they get a...
And he could have done the same to her, too.
Oh, I'm sure. Absolutely. So they get Claire and Jamie. They get a look at the room, and then they hear the noise again from above. That's Mr. Beardsley, we learn. Jamie, in order to get up there, Jamie had to climb a ladder to get to him. The description of Mr. Beardsley was that he had likely been quite a good size once upon a time, but... Over the approximately a month or so.
He was still a good size. Well, that's the whole thing.
No, he was
still big.
He was, you can have a large frame. Your frame will not diminish, but your roles will go away. So she described how he had been bigger, but that because of his malnourishment, his starvation, whatever, his body, talking about losing weight, what he went into was probably ketosis. So he probably lived off of that body fat, and
muscle.
Exactly, and the muscle. And so what's left is, at least on his arms, she described, his arms was like a lot of just like skin, hanging skin.
Skin and bones.
I'm sure, but that doesn't take the stature away from him.
So his frame is still large.
His frame will still be large. So all that means is that he has hanging flesh.
Yeah.
But it doesn't change the fact that he's still a large individual.
No, he's still, I'm sure, a big dude.
So she described him... Well, he had lots of slack flesh. One eye seemed to work. He couldn't talk. He could make noise, but he couldn't talk. Mrs. Beardsley said that he'd been like that maybe a month. She couldn't move him. He was too heavy. And apparently he'd been chasing her. He chased her up to the loft and he'd struck her. And in the middle of this kerfuffle, he'd had a stroke. So Claire examines the body. And while she does see that he has bed sores or sores from, you know, being immobile for so long, she also notices other injuries that were not attributed to that. She saw slices and she saw burns. And she makes her way through all the stuff and she smells gangrene. Now, what to do with Mr. Beardsley?
Well, she was like stepping on God knows what up there either.
She's just saying everything is squishy.
Squishy. Like
it was all squishy.
It's called poop and pee. She's like, I didn't know. It's called poop and pee.
She's like, I didn't know if it was rotten food she was stepping on or feces. And she was like, I didn't want to know. I didn't even look down. I just kept walking.
I mean, you knew what it was. Everyone knew what it was.
So
he was in his own piss and shit for a month.
Oh, that'll cause... infections of right there.
So she's going to have to amputate if he's going to survive. Claire asks Mrs. Beardsley if they'd have anyone nearby, any family, any friends who could help care like his aftercare. Nope. She explains, and I'd be very curious to learn a little bit more of her story, but what we do learn is very sad. She was taken. She says she was taken. So my guess is she may have been traded. She may have been sold or given away for some gain of her family or her father. But
women were property.
Absolutely. She said she was taken from her family.
I mean, that's true. So he maybe stole her. You never know.
No, I feel like that was not the impression I was given. I feel like he showed up and was like, I'm going to take such good care of her and I have all these things and I trade with all these people and I'm a great person and I have all these whatevers. It didn't feel to me that she was stolen. It felt like she was purchased.
Mm-hmm.
So we found out that she was taken from her family and but north of North Carolina, she was taken from her family in Maryland. Jamie is like, no more. I'm not playing anymore. So Jamie had gone and fetched the pistols anyway. They hear more noises from above. Jamie pulled Mrs. Beardsley away from Mr. Beardsley. So she was up there. They had gone down. Jamie had gone to get the pistols. He comes back. They hear more noises. He goes up there and sees she's trying to strangle him. And she actually almost succeeded. Mrs. Beardsley, when he's like, why are you doing this? And it's very telling. It's not that telling. It's understandable given her circumstance and given what she's shared thus far. She corrects him in that she doesn't want him dead. She wants him to die slowly. So that's another side of her.
Yeah. Well, if you had been, used and abused. She was probably raped on a regular basis, as well as beaten and everything else. And it's like, I might, after years of that, feel like watching someone die slowly who did that to me. I'm not going to lie.
I hear you. She's an abuse victim, and that screws with your brain. And so there's protective mechanisms, and then there's, you can get messed up in the head. So she has absolutely been abused, and we can't forget that although he is a type of, at the end of this chapter, he is a victim, or throughout what she's doing to him, he is a victim, but she was the first victim. She's a much more long-term abuse victim. So the goal is for her to operate, for her to do anything, they have to get him down. So Diana doesn't go into a lot of how they do it, but they use rope, I'm guessing like a pulley system, and between the two of them, they get him down. They lay him out on the clean table, and they clean and clothe him and feed him. Now, Claire is contemplating just how much that she'll need to amputate. You know, like she's like, I can do the toes, but it's not far enough. I could do the ankle. I mean, he's never going to walk again, so it doesn't really matter. But then she's like, oh my gosh, she realizes that if she does anything that's severely major or very major, she'll have to remain there for weeks with his aftercare. And she's just like, oh no. And Mrs. Beardsley does not want Claire to operate. She refuses to give her permission. But Jamie tells Claire to take Mrs. Beardsley outside. Jamie has made up his mind to offer something. So Claire takes Mrs. Beardsley outside, and it's just Jamie and Mr. Beardsley. Jamie communicates with Mr. Beardsley, and he understands that Mr. Beardsley understands. Claire hadn't left yet. Claire does not want to leave him. She says, if he does this thing that Jamie is thinking of, that he must have a witness. And he's like, okay, you're right. So Jamie, using the one blink, two blink, yes, no, eye communication method we've all heard of, Jamie asks Mr. Beardsley a series of questions, yes and no questions, to which he answers in front of Claire, so there is a clear witness. Does he know that his body, his condition is not mendable? Yes. Does he know that he'll die without a surgery? Quote, the quiet litany went on. So he's asking question after question to establish what he understands of his condition and then to take it to the end, what he was going to get to. Quote, the quiet litany went on, statements and questions, each a shovelful of dirt taken from a deepening grave, unquote. And Claire thinks, quote, my hands and feet and face felt numb. The odd sense of sanctuary in the room had altered. It felt like a church, but no longer a place of refuge, a place now in which some ritual took place, leading to a solemn, predestined end. And it was predestined, I understood. Beardsley had made his choice long since. perhaps even before we arrived. He had had a month in that purgatory, after all, suspended in the cold dark between heaven and earth, in which to think, to come to grips with his prospects and make his peace with death, unquote. So he gets to the nitty-gritty. Jamie asks, will you have my wife take your foot and tend your wounds? He answers, no. Do you ask me to take your life? He answers, yes. So Jamie's received his task, and he tells Claire to take, now for sure, take Mrs. Beardsley outside. Quote, I looked back at Beardsley, but he was my patient.
Should have just let Mrs. Beardsley take care of it.
I know.
She wanted to. She almost did it. I feel like it was such a letdown. They should have just let her finish it. Because that would have made her feel better. And it wouldn't have mattered to him because he'd still have the end result of being dead other than being shot in the face, which is quicker, obviously. But
yeah,
he was so close to being gone the first time. Yeah,
they talked about his face had turned black.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. So Claire takes Mrs. Beardsley outside. Quote, I looked back at Beardsley, but he was my patient no longer. His flesh beyond my healing of comfort, or my comfort. I went to the woman and took her by the arm, turning her toward the door. She came with me, walking mechanically, and did not turn to look back, unquote. So outside, Mrs. Beardsley, like, takes off as much as, I wrote the word runs. Now, I don't know that she ran, but she hobbled. She went as quickly as she could to the barn. Claire did not follow. And then she hears the shot, and she wonders, head or heart?
Doesn't he shoot him in like one of the eyes?
Yeah, that's the head.
Yeah.
I know, but face. I'm sorry. Head to me is like anything that's not on your face. Face is very specific. Face is like here.
The face is the front of your head.
Right. From like forehead to chin. But like head is like everything behind your face to me.
But like personally. Where's this is totally gruesome and horrible. But where's the best? I mean, if you want to make sure you die.
Obviously through the eyeball is amazing.
Is it? Yeah, what, are you sure?
Right into your brain. Because that's like soft tissue straight into your soft tissue.
I was just watching Drunk History. And they talked about that guy, which I've heard his story before, Gage, who was tamping something, and there was a tamping iron that they had explosives.
Oh, the railroad spike?
It went through his cheekbone right under his eye.
Yeah.
And like literally went behind his eye, under his eye, behind his eye, and out the top of his head, like a hole. And he was not, in fact, they had to convince him to go to the doctor.
It's like the chicken they kept alive for how many years had no head.
Yeah, and they took him to the doctor, and he still had all his cognitive function, everything. Thing is, it ruined his – the only thing it ruined was the frontal lobe, and so his personality completely changed. Yeah. And so he became kind of violent and became a completely different person. But that's what I'm thinking. I'm like, where – do you shoot somebody to make sure you don't want to have to shoot him a second time?
You have to think about it.
I've never
fired a gun. So it's not about that.
I fire guns, but at a target.
I know, but what I'm saying is I've never had bad experience. What I'm stating is that like the core of your brain is all right here. So what happened to him was like.
It was a dramatic angle.
Yeah. So if you were going.
Fairly straight in at the eye.
Straight through with like no like.
Major
hard
angle.
Like stops in between.
That's true. If you're going through the occipital lobe, hitting enough
of the lobes to like end it.
It would be softer. It'd be easier to get through to the brain. Probably.
That's what I'm thinking.
Huh.
I'm just because
I would hate to like be in his position and shoot the guy and have him be like still like squirming around, like not dead. And you're like, what the hell? I gotta shoot him again.
But to Jamie's credit, I think he would have shot him again.
Yeah, I know.
He wasn't gonna leave him
like slowly bleeding out of his head.
Though he deserved it.
I'm sorry. That's totally gruesome. But I'm just like,
what this is. Have you never been on the podcast? Do you forget what we do?
Talk about gross, disgusting things.
Not even gross, disgusting things. It's just like the conversations that evolve based upon what we're talking about.
Yeah.
So Jamie comes out after shooting and vomits. Claire's a little superstitious regarding like the spirit. Like, is the Donovan go in there? Is his spirit still hanging out in there? Mrs. Beardsley.
Like, but she was like, why is the door open? Yeah. Who opened the door?
Mrs. Beardsley was still in the barn, surrounded by her goats. And Claire goes out there and she, or sorry, Claire goes to see about the horses. So the horses had not been completely unsaddled and hobbled and all of that when they arrived. Jamie was going to, but then circumstances changed and they didn't get that far. So she takes care of the horses and she fills the trough with water and she looks up and sees that the back door was open. Now, Jamie was not inside. He was out digging the grave and he was crying. Now, they agreed they would not be sleeping there that night.
Yeah.
Thank goodness. And they would bury him as soon as they could, and then they'd be on their way. And he left the door open to let the soul go free. Now, Jamie has her go collect some stones for the cairn.
She was so surprised, though. She's like, really? A cairn? Really? We're waiting? Like, we're going to sit here long enough to build a cairn?
Yeah, I wouldn't. I just, like, put him in a shallow grave and call it good.
Yeah.
Yeah, but you don't want somebody coming across it unexpectedly. At least if you put a
cairn on it, people are
There were no forensic science of any kind back then. No, so it's not like they'd be like, oh, maybe Jamie did it.
You know? How jarring would that be? I mean, that's just like common courtesy. You're like, hey, don't dig here.
They could stick a rock, a big rock with a cross or a
here.
Stick in it. I don't know.
Dead things are here. Don't
dead
dig.
Things.
So they prep the body for burial. C cleans C. Man, this abbreviation thing.
You know,
Claire cleans
but
up.
But at this point, I got super pissed at Mrs. Beardsley because she was like, messing with his body for like months, just like burning parts of him that he couldn't feel. And she couldn't stick around long enough to like help bury him to like finish her own like personal purgatory.
Whatever.
She couldn't be like, I'm going to put a rest to this so I can walk away from this and never think about it again.
She didn't want to be. Yeah, no, I get it. I don't think I'd want to either. So she's as they're prepping the body, she sees that Jamie had shot him through his bad eye. So as they're burying him, he mentioned about his father having died from an apoplexy. And it clicks for Claire. She's like, oh my gosh, this is why this whole thing was so hard for him. His reaction in the room, his vomiting afterwards, his crying, you know, while digging the grave, like all of this is like, he can't have emotion for this poor man. Even if he felt bad for him, as far as, you know, being in his state, regardless of what he had done before he had been in that state. That's not really like Jamie. He is merciful, but he's also fair. So it makes sense, I think, to Claire. And of course, thereby the reader, once we find out that he's thinking of his father so much. And before he's thinking of, you know, did if my dad got this way or, you know, had his attack. And then as Jenny cared for him, you know, did he have incontinence? Did he drool? Was he not able to feed himself? He goes straight to, oh my gosh, this could have been my dad. You know, maybe not the size, maybe not the circumstances, but the condition as far as the stroke and losing your faculties.
Did his father die right away?
No. He was taken back to Lallybroch and Jenny cared for him.
He had his apoplectic fit.
Yeah.
When Jamie was being.
Yeah, I remember that, but I don't remember how long he was alive before he passed.
I don't think that they ever really discussed how long he wasted before he passed. However, personally, I forgot that until he brought it up again in this chapter. And I was like, oh, that's right. That's brutal. I'm sorry.
I don't know why I had it in my brain that like he literally had like a stroke and died right away.
Oh,
I didn't realize they took him back to Lallybroch. I don't know why.
Here's the larger issue is he doesn't know anything.
That's the thing.
Yeah.
He wasn't there. So it's not just that, oh my gosh, this could have been my dad. It's that it's where his brain goes because he doesn't know. He doesn't know how long he lasted, or at least we don't know. He doesn't know everything that Jenny had to go through while caring for him. He doesn't know much, if any, of that. And it's not just being unaware of things. It's that he never got to see his dad again. Like, it's not like he got sick and he missed out on his healing and then, you know, never asked his sister, oh, did he pee on himself, you know, before he got better? There was no getting better. So he never, and he was, you know, prepared to die himself. So he was, this is back when he was being his first two whippings, right?
Yeah.
So they bring the body, before they move the body out of the house, he asks Claire, and this, I have a question for you guys. He asks Claire, he says, if something happens to me as it did my father, quote, swear you will give me the same mercy I gave this wretched bugger here. Now, this makes me wonder if something like this, apoplexy or no, will be Jamie's end. Or is it something where Claire will have to keep her promise to him? So I'm just throwing it out there. We don't have to discuss it. I'm just curious if you guys have ever thought about this, because I forgot in summer when I brought something up akin to this topic, when we talked about that before privately, it was not because of this chapter. That was because of something else that I read that Diana had addressed. But when I was reading this chapter to take notes for this recording, I saw that and I went, oh, so forget apoplexy, forget his dad. I don't know if it happens anywhere else. I didn't go back and search. But here in book 5, chapter 27, he asks Claire to swear that she will basically mercy kill him if he's in a situation where he's not going to recover.
This Beardsley situation made real a situation that he has only imagined
a million times,
but has had no immediate experience with. So I think that for him, seeing somebody go through something that mirrors what potentially his father went through, he is not wishing that on anybody, which is why he was the first one to stand up and be like, dude, I'm going to end this for you. Do you want me to end it for you? If you want me to, say the word and I'll do it right now, because this is no way to live. So that is not unexpected that he would ask that, because he's not only thought about it as far as his dad is concerned, but he's now seen it from somebody who's been suffering for a month at least with the aftermath of his stroke. So I don't know what Diana has decided. We're at book 5 and I don't want to speculate any further than where we are right now.
It just always makes me think about someday at some end.
That's a really deeply planted seed. I'm not saying you're wrong. I'm just saying that's a really deeply planted seed.
I don't think it's a seed.
It's not out of the realm of possibilities.
But it is a seed. If she's planted it in book 5 for it to grow into something by book 10, absolutely it's a seed.
Well, it's very possible. She says to him, quote, I'll do what must be done. I whispered back at last, just as you did. And then they go to bury him. So she's basically made a promise. We don't know what's going to happen, but she's just promised something. Erica B. wraps us up with, what an unfortunate situation in the Beardsley home. The wife was torturing her husband for all the bad that he had done to her at the convenience of the stroke, making him lame and bedridden. I'm glad Jamie was there to talk with him and help him be out of misery. One can only imagine how long it would have continued. That's true. That's a good that's a good point.
How long does it take to die from gangrene?
I don't even know.
It has to go septic.
But it was gangrene in his feet. That's like the farthest point you can get away from somebody's heart.
The heart is when it starts to become.
Once it hits the heart, though.
Yeah.
But it has to make it all the way up. So once it hits the heart, then it's everywhere, because it pushes its way through your entire system.
Yeah, but I mean, the gangrene doesn't necessarily have to spread all the way up. It just has to be poisoning enough into the bloodstream. Yeah. And then once you see, you know, the red telltale streaks, which is always really scary.
Do you get red streaks with gangrene, though?
I don't know, but you do with blood poisoning.
But I wonder if he would have had lockjaw before.
That's tetanus.
I know, but they're all related. Like, they're all part and parcel. They all play with each other. I'm not a doctor,
apparently.
She just plays one on this podcast.
I just pretend to be one in this episode. But, I mean, they're all taintings of blood. I mean, it's like,
I would be curious. Hold on, I'm curious.
Tetanus versus blood poisoning.
How long versus gangrene? And how long does it take to die of gangrene?
Erica B. continues. Jamie digs a grave near a mountain ash tree, which, according to Wikipedia, is only a very small area in North Carolina in the Appalachian Mountains. The mountain ash tree is also known as the Rowan tree. So I furthered my Google search and came across this site, and she shares. TheGoddessTree.com, we'll put this in our show notes, which has which had this to say under its magical properties. Using meditation, Rowan is helpful with clearing the mind and opening our inspiration. The essence of Rowan is used in vibrational medicine to assist in attuning us to nature, broadening perspectives, and making room for a deeper understanding of our place here in the universe. It also has a significant role in protection. Rowan wood was traditionally used to make spindles and spinning wheels, tool handles, stakes and pegs, dowsing and divining rods. A Rowan wand or walking stick will protect you from being harmed on a journey and bring spiritual enlightenment along your path. To the Celts, the Rowan was a symbol of the hidden mysteries of nature and the quickening of the life force. Scottish tradition did not allow for the use of Rowan wood for any other purpose than ritual. And even further Googling led me, this is Beth, Erica, I'm making up names now, led Erica to discover that there is, in Celtic astrology, the Rowan trees is one of the zodiac signs. And she says, it looks like I'm a Hawthorn. And she finishes with, I am glad Jamie was finally able to mourn, or at least a little bit, begin to mourn the death of his father with the death of Mr. Beardsley, having not been able to do so in the moments after his father's death. Remember, he didn't know that his father, well, originally he didn't know that his father didn't die when he collapsed. He found out later that, and not in this chapter, much earlier, but later after that collapse, that he died later. So it's been a long process. But yes, he didn't know right away. So hopefully Jamie was able to find a bit of solace in Beardsley's death for his own sake.
And Lene, what did you find online?
Oh, I was just looking up. It takes about 48 hours to die. It can take about 48 hours to die from gangrene.
So he was getting close. Okay.
Once it gets really bad and it gets to the bloodstream. And then I'm looking up. I mean, tetanus, it's a bacterial infection. Is that, it causes spasm. It affects the nervous system. So it causes like muscles. That's what tetanus does. That's like kind of what like lockjaw and stuff like that is what people would call it.
And my statement previously was just purely about the fact that they were both bloodborne illnesses caused death.
Yeah. Well, they're all bacterial infections in the blood. But tetanus causes muscle spasming and your neck, especially in the neck and jaw, and then it can stop your breathing and it kills you. But,
I can stop your breathing.
Luckily
and I'll
for
kill
vaccines,
you.
We can not get it, which is awesome.
Exactly. If you'd like to join the conversation and be a contributor to our read along, please go to www.outlanderpod.com/fierycross. There's a link to our Google Drive spreadsheet that shows the available chapters. And if there are spots available, message me and let me know and I will add you to it.
As always, we'd love you to help us continue the conversation in our Facebook community. You can join us at outlanderpod.com/group. So thank you as always so much for listening. Thank you, Lene, for joining us.
Of course.
Thank you for having me.
We look forward to our next episode. Thank you to our generous partner, Zencastr, who offers high-fidelity podcasting. Check out Zencastr and use coupon code OUTLANDER20, OUTLANDER20, for 20% off 3 months or 20% off for a year. Connect with us. Visit our website at outlanderpod.com. Find us on Facebook, facebook.com/outlanderpod. We'd love for you to join our Facebook community at outlanderpod.com/group. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram at outlanderpod.